A Treatise on Indwelling Sin by Dr. John Owen in Modernized English. What we have proposed for consideration is the power and efficacy of indwelling sin. The ways by which it may be proved are many. I will begin with the term used in the verse mentioned before. It is a law. I find a law, says the apostle. It is because of its power and efficacy that it is called a law. So also the principle of grace in believers is a law. The law of the Spirit of life, Romans 8, verse 2, as we observed before, which is the exceeding greatness of the power of God in them, Ephesians 1, verse 19. Where there is a law, there is power. We will therefore show both what belongs to it as a law, in general, and also what is particular or proper in it, being the sort of law we have described. There are, in general, two things attending every law as such: its dominion and its efficacy. The word efficacy is the ability to produce a desired or intended result. First, its dominion. Romans 7, verse 1, the law has dominion over a man while he lives. That is, it lords it over a man. Where any law is in effect, it has dominion. It is properly the act of a superior, and its nature is to exact obedience by way of dominion. Now, there is a twofold dominion, just as there is a twofold law. There is a moral authoritative dominion over a man, and there is a real effective dominion in a man. The first is an affection for the law of God, the latter for the law of sin. The law of sin doesn't have in itself moral dominion. It doesn't have rightful dominion or authority over any man. But it does have what is equivalent to it, for which it is said to reign as a king, Romans 6:12, to lord it over us, or to have dominion over us, verse 14, just as a law in general is said to have in chapter 7, verse 1. But because it has lost its complete dominion in reference to believers, of whom alone we speak, I will not insist on this utmost extent of its power. But even in believers, it is still a law, even though it is not a law to them. Yet, as was said, it is a law in them. And though it doesn't have a complete and, as it were, rightful dominion over them, yet it will have dominion over some things in them. It is still a law, and it is a law in them, so that all its actings are the actings of a law. That is, it acts with power, even though it has lost its complete power of ruling in them. Even though it is weakened, its nature is not thawed. It is still a law, and therefore it is powerful. And because its particular workings, which we will consider afterward, are the ground of this title, so the term itself teaches us in general what we are to expect from it and what endeavors it will use for dominion, a dominion to which it has been accustomed. Secondly, a law, as a law, has an efficacy to provoke those who are opposed to it to do the things it requires of them. A law has rewards and punishments that accompany it. These secretly prevail on those to whom they are proposed, even though the things commanded are not very desirable. Generally, all laws have their efficacy on the minds of men from the rewards and punishments that are added to them. Nor is this law without the spring of power. It has its rewards and punishment. The pleasures of sin are the rewards of sin, a reward that most men lose their souls to obtain. By this means, the law of sin contended in Moses against the law of grace. Hebrews 11, verses 25 and 26. He chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, for he looked to the recompense of reward. The contest was in his mind between the law of sin and the law of grace. The motive on the part of the law of sin with which it sought to draw him over and with which it prevails on most was a reward that it proposed to him, namely, that he would have the present enjoyment of the pleasures of sin. By this, it contended against the reward added to the law of grace called the recompense of reward. By this sorry reward, this law keeps the world in obedience to its commands. And experience shows us what power it has to influence the minds of men. It also has punishments that it threatens men with who labor to cast off its yoke. Whatever evil, trouble, or danger there is in the world attends gospel obedience. Whatever hardship or violence is to be offered to the sensual part of our natures in a strict course of mortification, sin makes use of or takes advantage of as if they were punishments attending the neglect of its commands. By these it prevails on the fearful who will have no share in eternal life, Revelation 21:8. And it is hard to say by which of these, whether its pretended rewards or pretended punishments, it most prevails, or which of them its greatest strength lies in. By its rewards, it entices men to sins of commission, or entices them to commit the sins, as they are called, in ways and actions tending to satisfy its lusts. By its punishments, it induces men to omit or not do their duties, a course tending no less to a pernicious event than the former. By which of these the law of sin has its greatest success in and upon the souls of men is not evident, and that is because they are seldom, if ever, separated, but they equally act on the same persons. But this is certain, that by tenders and promises of the pleasures of sin, on the one hand, and by the threats of the deprivation of all sensual contentment and the affliction of temporal evils on the other, it has an exceeding effectiveness on the minds of men and often on believers. Unless a man is prepared to reject the reasonings that offer themselves from the one and the other of these, there is no standing before the power of the law. The world submits to these pleasures every day. Afterward, we will declare with what deceit and violence they are urged and imposed on the minds of men, and also what advantages they have to prevail upon them. Look at men in general, and you will find them wholly at sin's disposal by these means. Do the profits and pleasures of sin lie before them? Nothing can keep them from reaching after them. Do difficulties and inconvenience attend the duties of the gospel? Then they will have nothing to do with them. And so they are wholly given up to the rule and dominion of this law of sin. And so we have this light in general as to the power and effectiveness of indwelling sin from the general nature of a law of which it partakes. Next, we may consider what kind of law in particular it is, which will further evidence its power, which we are inquiring about. It is not an outward written commanding directing law, but an inbred, working, impelling, urging law. A law proposed to us is not to be compared for effectiveness to a law if it is inbred in us. Adam had a law of sin proposed to him in his temptation, but because he had no law of sin inbred and working in him, he might have been able to withstand it. An inbred law must necessarily be effective. Let us take an example from that law which is contrary to this law of sin. The law of God was at first inbred and natural to man. It was co-created with his faculties, and it was their rectitude, both in its being and operation, in reference to his end of living to God and glorifying him. So it was that it had a special power in the whole soul to enable it for all obedience. Yes, and to make all obedience easy and pleasant. Such is the power of an inbred law. And though this law as to its rule and dominion is now by nature cast out of the soul, its remaining sparks, because they are inbred, are very powerful and effectual, as the Apostle declares in Romans 2:14-15. Afterward, God renews this law and writes it in tablets of stone. But what is the efficacy of this law? Will it now, as it is external and proposed to men, enable them to perform the things that it exacts and requires of them? Not at all. God knew it would not, unless it were turned to an internal law again. That is, until from a moral outward rule, it is turned into an inward real principle. Which is why God makes his law internal again and implants it in the heart as it was at first, when he intends to give it power to produce obedience in his people. Jeremiah 31:31-33. I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts. This is what God intends, as it were, a discovery of the insufficiency of an outward law leading men to obedience. The written law, he says, will not do it. Mercies and deliverances from distress will not effect it. Trials and afflictions will not accomplish it. Then, says the Lord, I will take another course. I will turn the written law into an internal living principle in their hearts that will have such an efficacy that it will assuredly make them my people and keep them my people. Now, such is the law of sin. It is an indwelling law, Romans 7:17. It is a sin that dwells in me, verse 20. Sin that dwells in me, verse 21. It is present with me, verse 23. It is in my members. Indeed, it is so far in a man that in some sense it is said to be the man himself, verse 18. I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwells no good thing. The flesh, which is the seat and throne of this law, yes, which indeed is this law, is in some sense the man himself, just as grace is also the new man. Now from this consideration, that it is an indwelling law inclining and moving us towards sin, just as an inward habit or principle does, it has various advantages that increase its strength and further its power, such as, 1, it always abides in the soul. It is never absent. The apostle twice uses this expression, it dwells in me. There is its constant residence and habitation. If it came upon the soul only at certain seasons, much obedience might be perfectly accomplished in its absence. Yea, and just as they deal with usurping tyrants, whom they intend to thrust out of a city, the gates might be shut against it sometimes, so that it might not return. The soul might fortify itself against it. But the soul is its home. There is its dwelling, and it is no wanderer from it. Wherever you are, whatever you are about, this law of sin is always in you, and the best that you do, and in the worst. Men little consider what a dangerous companion is always at home with them. When they are in company, when they are alone by night or by day, all is one, sin is with them. There is a living coal continually in their houses, which if it is not looked after, will set them on fire and maybe consume them. Oh, the woeful security of poor souls! How little do most men think about this inbred enemy, that it is never away from home. How little, for the most part, does the watchfulness of any professor correspond to the danger of the state and condition. Secondly, it is always ready to apply itself to every end and purpose which it serves. It not only dwells in me, says the apostle, but when I would do good, it is present with me. There is something more in that expression than mere indwelling. An inmate may dwell in a house and yet not always meddle with what the good man of the house is doing. So we may keep to the illusion of indwelling used by the apostle. But it is so with this law. It so dwells in us that it is present with us in everything we do. Yea, oftentimes when, with the most earnestness, we desire to be rid of it, it will push itself upon us with the most force. When I would do good, it is present with me, Romans 7, verse 21. Would you pray? Would you hear sermons? Would you give alms to the poor? Would you meditate upon the word? Would you in any duty act out your faith in God and love towards Him? Would you work righteousness? Would you resist temptations? If so, this troublesome, perplexing indweller will still more or less force itself upon you and be present with you so that you cannot perfectly and completely accomplish the thing that is good, as our apostle speaks of it in verse 18. Sometimes men, by hearkening to their temptations, stir up and excite and provoke their lusts. No wonder then that they find them present and active. But it will be so when we labor with all our endeavors to be free from them. This law of sin dwells in us. That is, it adheres to us as a depraved principle, to our minds in darkness and vanity, to our affections and sensuality, to our wills and a loathing of and aversion to what is good. And by some, more or all of these is continually forcing itself upon us in its inclinations and in its motions, in its suggestions to evil, when we would most gladly be rid of it. Number 3. It being an indwelling law, it applies itself to its work with great facility and easiness, like the sin that so easily besets us, Hebrews 12, verse 1. It has a great facility and easiness in applying itself to its work. It needs no doors to be opened to it. It needs no engines to work by. The soul cannot apply itself to any duty of a man unless it is by exercising those faculties in which this law has its residence. Is the understanding or the mind to be applied to anything? There it is. Ignorance, darkness, vanity, folly and madness. Are you trying to engage your will? There is indwelling sin also, in spiritual deadness, stubbornness, and the roots of obstinacy. Are the heart and affections to be set to work? There is indwelling sin, in its inclinations to the world and present things, and to sensuality with proneness to all manner of defilements. Hence, it is easy for it to insinuate itself into all that we do, and to hinder all that is good, and to further all sin and wickedness. It has an intimacy, an inwardness with the soul, and therefore in all that we do it easily besets us. It possesses those very faculties of the soul by which we must do what we do, whatever it is, good or evil. Now it has all these advantages because it is a law, an indwelling law, which manifests its power and efficacy. It is always resident in the soul. It enforces itself upon all its actings, and it does that with easiness and its aptitude. This is that law which the apostle affirms that he found in himself. This is that title which he gives to the powerful and effectual remainder of indwelling sin, even in believers. And from that title, we have these general evidences of its power. There are many in the world who do not find this law in them, who, whatever they have been taught in the Word, do not have a spiritual sense and experience of the power of indwelling sin. And that is because they are wholly under its dominion. They do not find that there is darkness and folly in their minds, because they are darkness itself, and darkness will discover nothing. They do not find deadness and an indisposition in their hearts and wills to God, because they are wholly dead in trespasses and sins. They are at peace with their lusts by being in bondage to them. And this is the state of most men in the world, which makes them woefully despise all their eternal concerns. Why is it that men follow and pursue the world with so much greediness that they neglect heaven and life and immortality for it every day? Why is it that some pursue their sensuality with delight? They will drink and revel, and have their sports, let others say what they please. Why is it that so many live so unprofitably under the word preached, that they understand so little of what is spoken to them, that they practice less of what they understand, and that they will by no means be stirred up to respond to the mind of God in his calls to them? It is all from this law of sin, and the power of it rules and bears sway in men, that all these things proceed. But it is not about such persons that we particularly speak at present. From what has been said, it will ensue that if there is such a law in believers, it is doubtless their duty to find it out and find it to be so. The more they find of its power, the less they will feel of its effects. It will not all advantage a man to have a hectic distemper and not discover it, or have a fire burning secretly in his house and not to know it. As much as men find of this law in them, they will abhor it in themselves and no more. Also, in proportion to their discovery of this law will be their earnestness for grace, nor will it rise any higher than that. All watchfulness and diligence and obedience will correspond to it also. On this one hinge, finding out and experiencing the power and the efficacy of this law of sin, turns the whole course of our lives. Ignorance of it breeds senselessness, carelessness, sloth, security, and pride, all of which the Lord's soul abhors. Eruptions into great, open, conscious, destroying, scandalous sins are from a lack of a due spiritual consideration of this law. Inquire then, how is it with your souls? What do you find of this law? What experience do you have of its power and effectiveness? Do you find that it dwells in you? That it is always present with you, exciting itself, spreading its poison with easiness, and at all times, in all your duties, when you would do good? What humiliation, what self-abasement, what intenseness in prayer, what diligence, what watchfulness this calls for at our hands, what spiritual wisdom you stand in need of, what supplies of grace, what assistance of the Holy Ghost will also be discovered from this. I fear that few of us have a diligence that is proportionate to our danger. Chapter 2.